Hi, this is Jim Hightower. You're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM, a station that puts the public airwaves to work for the public. Imagine.
Friends, this is Maria Hall, co-host of the Lawyers Guild Show. My wonderful co-host Jim Lafferty is still out of town, but he's going to be back in just two more weeks. I can't wait because it's always fun to do this show with him. And in the meantime, well, it's been another eventful week for U.S. political news. How are you all doing out there? Are you okay? Are you energized because people are paying attention and talking about big issues we're facing as a society? Or are you feeling a little more demoralized because it seems like no one on the national stage really cares about your rights or interests? If you're like me, you're probably alternating between those extremes minute by minute. It is an exciting time, but it's also a scary time. So for this hour, I'd like to challenge all of us to take a step back, take a deep breath, and remember that, yes, it's often the most obnoxious and arrogant people who get the most attention on the mainstream news. But there are also brilliant, brave, compassionate people working behind the scenes to make the world better. So I'm going to introduce you to two of those people today, who are using their knowledge and skills to educate, advocate, and speak the truth, even if and when it becomes politically dangerous for themselves to do so personally. First, I'll be speaking with constitutional law scholar Stephen Rohde about the Supreme Court's recent decisions and what we the people need to know right now to protect our democracy. Then I'll be joined by Luis Cortez Romero, an immigration lawyer who is himself undocumented. He's the subject of a new documentary on PBS called From Here, From There. And he's going public with his story, even though it could be dangerous. So without further ado, let's turn to our first topic, the United States Supreme Court. Those nine justices with lifetime appointments who, with a majority vote of only five of them, have the power to grant or deny civil rights and liberties for over 300 million people, including you and me. It's hard work reading through those long Supreme Court decisions, though, and figuring out what they mean. That's why I'm so happy to have with us today someone who does that work dutifully in order to share it with the rest of us, to tell us what we need to know. He is constitutional law scholar, lecturer and author Stephen Rohde. Steve practiced law for decades and continues to be a powerful advocate for social justice, peace, and civil rights and liberties. Steve Rohde is the author of American Words of Freedom, which examines the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, and the Bill of Rights. On issues of civil rights, civil liberties, and the American political system, he's also a regular contributor to Truthdig, LA Progressive, Los Angeles Review of Books, and LA Lawyer magazine. Steve is a co-host on Law and Disorder Radio. Full disclosure, I'm also a co-host occasionally on that show. And I'm especially excited to announce, drumroll, that Steve is launching his podcast on MS Media this fall called Speaking Freely, a First Amendment podcast with Stephen Rohde. Steve Rohde, welcome to the Lawyers Guild Show.
Maria, thank you very much. It is a pleasure to be with you.
Well, it's always an easy show for me because you are always prepped. So let's go ahead and start us off by breaking down the Supreme Court's July 1st, 2024 decision in Trump versus United States, one of the more talked about Supreme Court decisions in this year. Remind us of the ruling, the rationale, and what the impact may be on the numerous cases still pending against Trump.
Well, thank you, Maria, for affording me this platform to get across to listeners and then for them to talk with everyone they know about this dangerous U.S. Supreme Court in the grip of a six-member ultra-conservative majority. And, you know, Donald Trump, over his career, has recruited obedient enablers throughout his work who have compliantly cleared the way for him to lie and to steal and to conspire to get whatever he wants. Well, this has reached the U.S. Supreme Court. It wasn't just this term. It was previous terms, turning back the 50-year-old Roe v. Wade and other longstanding precedents. But this time, in the case, and listen to the name of this case, Donald J. Trump versus the United States of America. That's the name of the case. And it couldn't stand more clearly for what's at stake here. So these justices, 6-3, with a stalwart, strong dissent from Justice Sotomayor and Jackson and Kagan, three women liberal justices trying to uphold the Constitution, the majority invented presidential immunity. Now, you've had me on this show. I try to speak with authority, with accuracy, without hyperbole. And for me to say that these six justices invented a political constitutional doctrine is quite something, and I stand behind it. Now, what I want to do with a few minutes here is to really break this case down, because it was in the news headlines. It's gone because of everything else that's happening. But your listeners and all of us need to understand what this court did on July 1st was three things. They gave Trump a personally designed, tailor-made, stay-out-of-jail card. They did it in three steps. First, they gave him absolute immunity for crimes committed when a president engages in the so-called core official acts, and they gave a near conclusive presumption of immunity for all other official acts. Secondly, they created a brand new rule of criminal procedure, making a president's motives irrelevant in a criminal trial. And thirdly, they created a new rule which excludes evidence of the president's official acts in a criminal trial for his unofficial acts. So they just did their work. They did the heavy lifting here. And listen to the remarks of the dissents. These are just key words in those dissents. In the case of Justice Sotomayor, she wrote a blistering 30-page dissent, joined by the other two justices, Kagan and Jackson. Sotomayor called the ruling deeply wrong, nonsensical, disastrous, troubling, utterly indefensible, twisted irony, newly minted core immunity, extraordinary, and a law-free zone. Instead of following the custom of ending her dissent respectfully, she ended it ominously. She said, "With fear for our democracy, I dissent." And Justice Jackson wrote her own searing and analytical 22-page dissent, calling the majority decision flawed reasoning, concocted, breaks new and dangerous ground, devised from whole cloth, oddity, a five-alarm fire, intolerable, unwarranted, and plainly antithetical to bedrock constitutional norms. Now, if I try to make my language reasonable, these are justices sitting down the hallway from the men who issued that devastating decision. So I want to just get across a few fundamental principles. You know, back 2 years ago when they struck down Roe v. Wade, these conservatives demanded that the text of the Constitution give guidance for what it means. They found the word abortion was not in the Constitution. They found even the word privacy was not in the Constitution, and so they obliterated Roe v. Wade. Well, guess what? Presidential immunity is not in the U.S. Constitution. There's no such word for it. And what they've done is given the leader of the Republican Party a pass by abandoning their originalism, which they've used to hack away at all of our rights. And now, instead of originalism, they just look to history and how this would put a burden on the president if he had to look over his shoulder at committing crimes. Well, Justice Sotomayor not only said that it was not included in the Constitution, she said it was considered and rejected. James Madison came to the Constitutional Convention and he considered whether or not there should be, quote, privileges ought to be allowed to the executive. It was on the table and they never adopted it. Delegate Charles Pinckney commented, no privilege was intended for the executive. In Federalist 69, Alexander Hamilton confirmed that former presidents would, listen to this, quote, be liable to prosecution and punishment in the ordinary course of the law. And Sotomayor gives other examples. Then in modern history, Lawrence Walsh was independent counsel in the Iran-Contra matter, and he stated, quote, because a president, and clearly a past president, is subject to prosecution, the conduct of President Reagan in the Iran-Contra matter was reviewed by independent counsel against applicable statutes. All of this ignored by the majority. And perhaps the most damning evidence was Trump himself. Let's go back to his second impeachment trial in 2021 to encourage senators to vote against convicting him on impeachment. Trump's lawyers argued that, quote, no former office holder is immune, unquote, end quote, from investigation, prosecution, or punishment. And that if any of the senators thought that Trump had committed a crime, quote, his lawyers, after he's out of office, you can go and arrest him. That is Trump's lawyers. None of this was given any weight by these conservatives. They marched through all the history to get to their result-oriented conclusion to give Trump immunity. You know, the nation and 46 presidents over 235 years have functioned without insulating presidents from prosecution for crimes committed in office. And now in this judicial fiat, they've created this immunity. It's already having an impact on his cases. The day after the case came down, remember, he was convicted of 34 felonies and he was supposed to be sentenced on July 11. His lawyers rushed into that New York state court and pointed to the Supreme Court case and said, wait a minute, we need time. We think this case may eliminate or diminish his convictions in that case. And so the sentencing was delayed until September 18. This case will have impacts in Florida, in Washington, in Georgia. All of these cases are now being examined. And my last point before we move on, buried in the immunity case, unbeknownst to most observers, was an opinion by Justice Clarence Thomas. Now, the issue of the appointment of Jack Smith, the independent counsel, wasn't at issue in the case. Justice Thomas wrote a blueprint that Jack Smith was wrongly appointed and was illegally serving as independent special counsel. That opinion was essentially blocked and copied by the justice in Florida, and she threw out Trump's charges on the documents case entirely, threw it out, saying Jack Smith was never properly appointed, and she got the idea from Clarence Thomas. This is what we're facing. This is what the court has already done just in July of this year.
Wow. Well, for listeners just tuning in, this is Maria Hall, and you're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM, The Lawyers Guild Show. Right now, I am speaking with our guest, constitutional law scholar Stephen Rohde. We're talking about the Supreme Court recent decisions. And Steve, usually I ask this question at the end, but I want to ask it twice this time. Where can people go if they, because we are going to switch over to the First Amendment cases now, but where can people go to learn more about Trump versus the United States and basically figure out what we can all do to save democracy?
Well, what you've heard from me today is a sample of a comprehensive article I've written on Trump immunity for the Los Angeles Review of Books. This will be published shortly. We will give you the word to announce on the show and at the KPFK billboard. And anyone can go to LA Review of Books and search for Stephen Rohde, because I could not rest without fully examining that case in detail in a way that I think, as perhaps you saw today, is understandable, digestible, and really gets across the threat that case poses to our democracy.
I know one of my favorite quotes or things to say is no one is above the law. And I don't know if I can say that anymore.
No, I can big say exception. It big exception now.
Yeah. Okay. Well,
no one should be above the law. That's what you're saying, right?
Yes. Yes, exactly. In my ideal world. But okay, so let's turn a little bit to the First Amendment. There were several important First Amendment decisions this past month and a half. So in broad strokes, why don't you just give us a survey of three or four, and then we can go one by one. Just let us know what are the ones that are on your radar.
Well, hope springs eternal, and it was in the area of the First Amendment that this court found some common ground. And you know of my background, and anything that supports a robust First Amendment is good news to me. So there was a case, which we'll explain, involving the National Rifle Association versus Vulo. There was a relatively companion case called Murthy, which we'll explain, that was very closely related, but came out differently. And finally, there was a set of cases, the Moody cases involving social media and some laws passed in Texas and in Florida.
All right. Well, let's start off then. You might think National Rifle Association of America versus Vulo would be about guns, but it's actually about freedom of speech, isn't it? What's the backstory here? And how did it get to the Supreme Court? What was decided?
Yes, it is. So Volo is the last name of the director of financial services of New York State. After the Parkland shooting, she and Governor Cuomo went after the National Rifle Association. Now I'm going to pause there because if my entire description ended there, me and many of our listeners would be cheering for going after the National Rifle Association. But you know, and I think we've talked about it on this program and elsewhere, when it comes to the First Amendment, you got to check yourself. Because what the state of New York did is they threatened insurance companies that provided insurance policies for NRA members, and they intimidated and coerced those insurance companies not to do business with the NRA, or else they would pursue them civilly and criminally. And many of those insurance companies backed off at the bidding of Governor Cuomo and New York State. So when you test First Amendment cases, you got to switch the facts. What if a state government went after Planned Parenthood and threatened insurance companies not to insure Planned Parenthood, or went after any other organization that you or I may support? LGBT groups, immigrant rights groups, etc. And that's why, guess who represented the NRA in the U.S. Supreme Court? The ACLU. And the ACLU was right to do it, and I publicly defended their decision to do it, even though they were trashed in many quarters, and they won a unanimous decision. All nine justices, including Sotomayor, Jackson, and Kagan, and the six conservatives, joined in an opinion by Justice Sotomayor. It's a clear, well-read, well-written opinion worth everyone's reading. She harked back to a case from 1962 where in Massachusetts, the sheriff went after sexually explicit books and magazines and threatened distributors, and that kind of coercion to punish free speech was found then by the United States Supreme Court to violate the First Amendment. So that case was applied here. The NRA case is at the trial stage. Now it's going to go forward into trial, and Justice Sotomayor said, if the allegations can be proved, that constitutes a First Amendment violation. That companion case of Murthy came out of other states where they were suing the Biden administration for, they alleged, coercing social media to take down information on COVID testing, some COVID opposition to masks, and anti-vaxxers and all the rest. Now, once again, it tests our beliefs, because much of us believe that that stuff was crazy. But crazy sometimes is protected by the First Amendment. And so this case was teed up to follow the NRA case, but unfortunately a majority of the court found that the plaintiffs in that case had no standing to bring the case. So the case was thrown out. Now, there were three dissents, and you're not going to hear me say this a lot, but the dissents were written by Alito, Thomas, and Gorsuch, and I agreed with them. They said there was standing, there was coercion of these social media sites to take down disfavored messages, and they believe the case should have gone forward. That's what happens in these cases sometimes. But luckily, the principles in both cases stands. You cannot coerce people to not do business with others to punish them for their free speech. And finally, the Moody case. This was a test of laws that Florida and Texas passed claiming that these private social media sites were censoring conservative voices. And the case was again teed up For a good, sharp examination of the First Amendment and social media and the intersection. But unfortunately, in that case, the majority went off on the theory that it was a facial challenge. This is very technical, not an as-applied challenge. And as a result, the case was sent back for further proceedings. We're going to hear more about that case in the future.
So was that, can you just put that again into some simple terms? Was that the states were claiming that these social media sites were only censoring Republicans, for example, and yes, not Democrats?
Yeah, they claimed it was viewpoint discrimination. The problem is that viewpoint, you can't sue the New York Times op-ed page for viewpoint discrimination. They choose what columns to publish. They choose what, that's a private publication. And in the case of social media, people forget. These are private platforms, and I want to keep them private. I want to keep the government out of dictating the content on social media. So those two laws did pose a serious threat, and I hope when they come back to the court, they will apply their unanimous decision in the NRA case and strike down those state laws.
All right. And those were brought by, was it Florida and Texas?
Brought against those states by various users of social media.
Right. Okay. Well, we have just a couple minutes left, Stephen Rohde. So I would love to take those couple of minutes to put it all together. Which way is the wind blowing? Where is the Supreme Court and our country headed? And then, of course, don't forget to leave a minute at the end to, again, remind us where we can learn more.
Well, it's as risky and threatening as it was at the beginning of the show, because the court made decisions. In addition to absolute immunity, they struck down a 40-year-old doctrine that required judges to defer to the expertise of administrative agencies in the area of clean air and clean water, cutting back on those limits. They ruled that January 6 insurrectionists could seek dismissal of some of their charges. They ruled that local governments could penalize unhoused Americans for sleeping outside. They held that U.S. citizens didn't have a liberty interest in having non-citizen spouses admitted to the country. And they reversed a lower court ruling from South Carolina's congressional map that had found it was unconstitutional racial gerrymandering. This court is marching through the law. They are taking their cue from the Republican platform and Project 2025. They are checking all the boxes to do the work in the court that Republicans may not be achieving at the ballot box and in the legislatures. It is literally one of the most dangerous periods with a highly reactionary Supreme Court at stake. What can we do about it? There's no fear for a second Trump term if he doesn't get elected. Presidents appoint Supreme Court justices. There could be one, two, or three vacancies in the next 4 years. And speaking personally and not for any organization, I want President Kamala Harris making those choices, not somebody else. There is moves to reform the Supreme Court so that we could have term limits. And there are other moves afoot because of the code of ethics. Two justices voted in these cases, Justice Thomas and Alito, under a cloud of ethical violations, which the U.S. Supreme Court is refusing to take care on its own. So we need a code of enforceable conduct against the Supreme Court. And there are bills pending in the Senate and the House. And I am asking for an invitation to return to the Lawyers Guild show in future weeks to talk about these bills pending in Congress, to hold justices of the Supreme Court to the same ethical standards as all federal judges currently must abide by. We've got to take this by the neck. we can't let these six conservative justices root through all of our personal liberties. And that's the work we've got cut out for us.
Well, Steve Rohde, you have an open invitation to visit us here on the Lawyers Guild Show. Like I said, you're always so prepared. You've done your homework so that the rest of us don't have to. Whew. And then I am just waiting for the Supreme Court to have to decide whether or not Supreme Court justices get absolute immunity.
You're right. You're really reading the crystal ball.
I don't want to tempt fate. But thank you so, so much for being here once again. Stephen Rohde, constitutional law scholar, author, lecturer, and activist. And you were an activist for peace even after 9/11. That was when you really came out and started being peaceful, even though there was a lot of momentum towards war. So I know that you're very brave. Yes, your shirt, he's got a shirt on, Peace Town. Yes. So thank you so much. Very grateful for you and your friendship. And of course, for your willingness to share here on KPFK.
Oh, thank you so much, Maria. Thanks for what you do every day.
Thank you. We will talk to you soon. And for listeners, we're going to take a 30-second break, and then we're going to return with a very special immigration lawyer.
Hello, I'm Armistead Maupin, author of Tales of the City. IMRU Radio Magazine has been the voice of the LGBT community in Southern California since 1974. And you can listen every Monday night from 7 to 8 p.m. right here on KPFK.
All right, welcome back. This is the Lawyers Guild Show. I'm your co-host, Maria Hall. At the top of the hour, I promise to introduce you to two guests who are using their knowledge and skills to educate, advocate, and speak truth, even if it becomes politically dangerous for themselves to put themselves out there. And I was just speaking with constitutional law scholar Stephen Rohde about some of the more important Supreme Court decisions and what we, the people, can do to protect our democracy. And now I'm very happy to introduce you to our second guest today, attorney Luis Cortez Romero. Luis is unusual because while helping his clients obtain lawful immigration status, he himself is undocumented. How can this be? Well, Luis was among hundreds of thousands of young people in the U.S. who received DACA, which stands for Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. Luis was able to graduate from law school, sit for the California bar exam, which he passed, and is now practicing law. But DACA does not grant legal permanent residency or citizenship. So what does that mean for Luis to be undocumented, especially in this political climate? Well, in spite of the dangers posed by going public with his story, Luis is the subject of a beautiful new documentary called From Here, From There. It's airing on PBS this month. The film chronicles Luis's journey from his childhood in Northern California to his rebellious punk rock years, including a mohawk, to studying law, and ultimately appearing with an all-star legal team before the U.S. Supreme Court to challenge the Trump administration's attempt to end DACA back in 2019-2020. So today, Luis is a partner at Novo Legal in Washington, and he teaches as an adjunct professor at University of Minnesota Law School. He serves on the board of the National Immigration Project, and he's won so many awards for his advocacy, leadership, professionalism, and volunteerism. Luis Cortez Romero, welcome to the Lawyers Guild Show.
So much for having me.
Sure. So, yeah, I see now that your hair is short, no mohawk today. But that was a great part of the show. So I've interviewed many immigration lawyers here on the Lawyers Guild Show. The Lawyers Guild has a very vibrant, robust immigration committee. But I've never before interviewed a lawyer who was also undocumented. So before we talk about your journey, can you answer a more basic question? Is the practice of law, being a lawyer, is that a career available to all undocumented people in the U.S.? And if not, where is it legal?
That's a really good question. And I think one that is an open question, I would say. So starting with what the law says, there is a federal law that generally prohibits a state body to provide a license for a professional license to someone unless the state passes some sort of legislature for them to do so. So for in other words, if we're talking about like a nursing license or a teaching license or any kind of other professional license, a medical license, there needs to be some sort of state legislative act in order for them to get it. The practice of law is a little different because we are regulated by the courts. And so there is a question about whether the legislature can tell the courts who they can and can't admit to practice law. And so where this question has come up, at least the states that have recognized it, because now there are more DACA recipient lawyers that are popping up kind of as the years has gone by, they have acknowledged that, you know, they will allow them to practice law and have admitted them. So as it's been coming up, it seems to be more and more available to them.
Wow, that's so interesting. Well, can you walk us through your particular journey to becoming a lawyer? You were introduced to American immigration law as a child with your own family, right? How did this impact the young and vulnerable Luis?
I think as it impacted me, it was part of my everyday life, and I saw the very real world practical consequences of it, and the disparities that it caused. What the privileges that you were able to have if you had legal statuses, than if you weren't, the separations of families, and just all of it. And so, as I was getting older, I was honestly getting kind of sick of the topic, and I wanted to almost like run away from it as much as possible. So when I began to have an interest in the law and went to law school, immigration law was actually the last thing I wanted to do. I did not want to do it. I wanted to do anything but that. And I was very interested in working with families who had been separated from CPS. So when the state intervenes because there's some sort of allegations of neglect, abuse, or abandonment. So I really wanted to work with that kind of population. But where I went to law school at the University of Idaho, they have an immigration clinic, and they needed help because they needed a Spanish speaker. And this was my first year in law school, and I, being a Spanish speaker, begrudgingly said yes, because I did not want to go back into it, really coming into that law school, like vowing to not do immigration law. But I was able to really fall in love with it. And I was able to also, I realized that I had a cultural capital that I felt was important to use in representing and helping clients, and having a vantage point about how to ask questions and what they might be thinking at this time, and concerns that they may have. So I can almost preempt some of their concerns and answer for them. And having that capacity, I think, really helped foster a relationship. And before I knew it, I started picking up immigration cases at the clinic.
Wow. Well, the need will, it's so overwhelming. But also, I remember from watching the film about your undergrad degree. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so I ended up going to undergrad at, I first went to community college. I was told pretty early on in high school that I was that just college wasn't available to undocumented students. So I did not take high school seriously at all. And my grades really reflected that. As also, as the film also depicts, my dad was deported during this time too. So it was just a very turbulent time. And so by the time, I was about to graduate high school, someone had mentioned like, no, there is availability for undocumented students to go to college. It might be tougher, but it's there because as undocumented students, we can't get financial aid. So we can't get student loans, and we're not We can't make ourselves available to grants or things like that. So really all we have is like private scholarships, which are very competitive because everybody's trying to get money from somewhere, right? And so, but I ended up going to community college. And from there, I went to San Jose State University and graduated with in sociology. And from there, I really like focused on why communities, you know, changed and were they where they were. Why is Chinatown in San Francisco Chinatown? Like, how did that become to be? How do these immigrant communities really kind of cluster themselves throughout the years and maintain their structure? And that was really interesting to me from a sociological perspective. And then it evolved onto law school.
Wow, that's really cool. Well, when you enrolled as a law student, I don't remember the year it was, but you can tell us, but there was no DACA yet, right? And it still wasn't legal in any state for an undocumented lawyer, or at least I don't think there were any, at least not in California at that time, where you didn't even have the hope of practicing, right?
Right. So that's completely right. So I went to law school in 2010, and I went into it kind of ignorantly, thinking like, I didn't realize how my immigration status was going to impact my ability to obtain a law license of practice. But when I was there, my first year when I was there, I had read an article from a undocumented student from UCLA who had gone to law school, but it was having a difficult time, like, figuring out whether he can get admitted to the bar or not. And like, I think ultimately quit from UCLA. And it's kind of dawned on me, like, of course this is going to be an obstacle. Like, what was I thinking? And so I was in the middle of my first semester finals, and I was at the University of Idaho, where it was really, really snowy. I remember not getting acclimated to the snow very well because I grew up in San Francisco, where the coldest it gets is like maybe 60 degrees. And so, and I called my mom and I told her that I was quitting, that it was really, really difficult. And trying to gather up the funds to pay for law school because it's really expensive, and just really trying to make it work was just really taxing. And if I wasn't going to get to practice law at the end of it, like it just didn't seem worth it. And man, she gave me the sternest talking to I think she's ever given me, and essentially told me that, you know, we don't get to these kind of spaces easily, and that they can't unteach us what they teach us at these institutions, and so that I should just continue with it, get as much as I can from it, and then we'll just figure the rest out of it later. And it was really, you know, like my mom's a very religious person, so she believes a lot in faith, and so I think that's what she was trying to project onto me, like just have faith that things are going to work out and just keep going and don't give up now. And so on the phone with her, I was crying and I was like, okay, I guess I'll continue to tough it out and we'll just see what happens. And then right before I was going to graduate, DACA gets announced.
Oh, that is incredible. And I see why your story was made into a film, because, you know, screenwriters, they go for that hero's journey motif. You dive in, you put 100% behind it, you have no reasonable hope of success, but you do it anyway and give it all you got. And and your mom, by the way, is a superstar, extremely charismatic, beautiful human being, you can tell. And hopefully she's listening out there. If not, I'll send you the recording. But the fates aligned, and you not only graduated from law school, but then passed the California bar exam, which I personally know, you know, it's not the easiest test in the world. And then you landed a case that was big time news, and including in the film, I saw people that I know of, Mark Rosenbaum and, you know, some famous lawyers, Professor Chemerinsky. He was one of my professors back at USC Law. So tell us about that case, that journey that you took, in your own words, go for it.
So this is now February of 2017. And at the time, President Trump had just gotten elected. And you know, he had said a lot of things about immigration, but he was kind of wishy-washy on DACA. I do remember at one point he said he was going to treat DACA recipients with heart. I remember the verbiage very specifically because I was like, what does that mean? But and so it was unclear what he was going to do. And so as his presidency was going along, you know, we already started seeing some of the anti-immigrant policies started coming to play, like the Muslim ban and things like that was already starting to happen. And so, but I get a phone call from this young man named Tony, and he calls me and he lets me know that his brother Daniel had been detained and that his brother Daniel has DACA and that ICE was around. They were not looking for Daniel, but they just happened to stumble upon Daniel. And they arrested him. And Daniel kept telling them, like, I have DACA. And they said that that doesn't matter. And so they arrested him and they detained him. And so his brother just started calling lawyers to see who can help. And this was like on a Friday. And so I was his like maybe fifth or sixth call at the time. So he had already was going down a list of people. And, but because it was Friday, he was being told like, well, if your brother's detained, I'll just go see him on Monday. It's already Friday. And, I remember getting the call and thinking, man, if it was me, and that very well could be me, I would be freaked out. I would want answers now. And so I took the call. And at first I told Tony, like, this must be a misunderstanding. He'll get released right away. Don't worry. And then a few hours later, he called me and he said, he's in there. They're not letting him go. And so that's when I started getting worried. And I talked to Daniel. It makes no sense as to why he's detained. And then I start sending just emails to whoever I could saying, like, is this the new normal? Like, is DACA going to be over like by death by 1,000 paper cuts where they don't announce the ending of the program, but they're just going to detain everybody and that's how they're going to do it? And so so this is on a Friday. I send a bunch of emails out, and the person who gets back to me the next day is this gentleman by the name of Mark Rosenbaum. And he sends me a message, and we get on the phone, and he says, I heard about this case. I want to help. And I said, okay, great. And, you know, I was like, let me investigate a little bit more because sometimes there's more that meets the eye. So let me continue investigating. And Mark said, okay, let's talk tomorrow, Sunday. And I said, okay. Sunday comes around and Mark calls me and he says, hey, like, we're still good to talk. I flew up here from Los Angeles. I'm now in Seattle. I'm like, oh, okay. I'll go pick you up at the airport. And so we go talk to Daniel on what I thought was going to be my free Sunday. You know, Mark is very concerned about what's happening. And he said, you know, do you mind if we go back to your office? So now we go back to my office, and there's another attorney waiting there from this firm called Gibson Dunn. I did not know who they were at the time, but there's this humongous firm. And we start working, and then Mark just starts calling people. And next thing you know, I recognize Professor Chemerinsky's voice because he was on my bar review class. And so I remember his voice and being like, and then he starts calling other professors. He's just calling Professor Tribe. And next thing you know, he just starts putting the team together, and we just start figuring out what is DACA legally and when can the government take it away and what protections does it actually have from a constitutional perspective. And we spend hours on a Sunday just trying to figure it out. And at the end of that initial meeting, we kind of figured, I don't think we have a legal case. And I think it's one of those things where the government can take it away if for no reason. And we don't think that there might be much protections here. So we all kind of leave very defeated, and we say, well, it was an interesting weekend. Thank you, everybody. And you know, we tried. And then Mark calls me again at about this time at 11:30 and at night and says, I think we figured it out. We jump in a call. We have a legal theory. And he says, okay, well, we have to file first thing tomorrow morning. So we have to draft through the night. And I laughed because I thought he was kidding. But he was very serious that we have to get everything together through the night. And that's when I realized really like the capacity of a Gibson Dunn team, because they had already a bunch of people ready to go. And so next thing you know, we're working and preparing through the night, and we file on behalf of Daniel.
Oh, my God. I have goosebumps listening to you, because just thinking about everything that came together for that. So let's talk a little bit more about DACA. And for listeners who are just tuning in, this is Maria Hall, KPFK 90.7 FM, Lawyers Guild Show. I'm speaking to Luis Cortez Romero, immigration attorney. So as we sit here today, what is the current status of DACA? And are DACA recipients like you protected from being deported? You know, what are the next steps? Because, oh, I forgot to say, you won.
So
how did I forget to say that?
Eventually, in September of 2017, the Trump administration announces the end of DACA altogether. And the benefit that we had on working with Daniel's case is that we already had legal theories kind of tested about what constitutional protections and everything else DACA could and could not have. And so we filed a lawsuit on behalf of several different DACA recipients in order to try to protect DACA from the end of the program. And when the case went to the Supreme Court during that time, eventually heard arguments in November to 2019, there was two questions that the court wanted to figure out. One of them was, is DACA legal to begin with? In other words, could President Obama even do a DACA program the way that he did? And then the second one is, did President Trump end the program correctly? Because when you're going to end a federal program, there's a way that you have to do it. And so those are the two questions that were before the court. Well, the Supreme Court at the time only answered the second question, which was President Trump did not end the program correctly. And the way in which President Trump's administration ended the program violated the Administrative Procedures Act. So admin law, basically. And so the termination of the program was deemed improper and therefore invalid. So the program was reinstated. But that first question, is DACA legal to begin with, was not answered. So once the Trump administration ended, Texas and a conglomerate of other conservative states continued a lawsuit to basically pick up where the court left off, which is DACA legal to begin with, yes or no? Because if that question gets answered and that the program is not legal, then the program goes away completely, no matter how you end it. And so they Texas filed in a very they knew what court they were filing in, and they filed in a court with where they knew the odds of them getting a judge that already had skepticism about the program would be picked. And that's exactly what happened. We got Judge Hainan, who for years had some skepticism about the DACA program and had very publicly mentioned that. It had gone up to the Fifth Circuit, which has kind of been stuck there for a while. And so the Fifth Circuit is about to hear oral arguments on that case in October of this year. And this case inevitably is going to go back to the Supreme Court to answer the first one of the questions that it didn't answer last time. Is DACA legal to begin with? And now we have a different composition of the court. At that time in 2019, we had Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and the kind of dispositive vote was Chief Justice Roberts, right, which ultimately ruled in our favor. But now we have a much more conservative leaning court and other justices who already voted against the DACA program at the time. So I think we're very clear-eyed about kind of what we think the life term of the DACA program is going to be, which is as soon as it hits the Supreme Court, which really calls for a larger legislative fix.
Wow. And then in the meantime, I mean, you're representing people, you're fighting for the rights of others. And do you feel like they are, you know, what is the sort of risk level out there? And maybe also just explain again what DACA actually is, and if it's a pathway to citizenship, which, you know.
Right. Yeah, maybe yeah, I think Yeah, you know, one of the things about the DACA program is that it provided just the basic building blocks of life. It gave us what is called lawful presence. So we're the government knows we're here and is allowing us to be here. They do it for 2-year increments. So every 2 years, we have to pay to the government again to reapply. They take our fingerprints. They go through a whole biographical and biometric information, all of these background checks to make sure that we're not a threat to the community. And then we get renewed for every 2 years. But it does not give us a pathway to legal permanent residency. It does not give us a pathway to U.S. citizenship. It just allows us to be here and work, basically. And the United States has a kind of a unique immigration system where it's not like other countries where you can go and then just apply to stay there or apply for citizenship based on the job that you have or what you can contribute. You actually have to have somebody sponsor you. And even then, there it's a landmine filled map of all these things that you have to kind of work through. And part of the reason for that is that the immigration laws are quite antiquated. And so it doesn't really reflect kind of the modern day structure of what kind of is happening in immigration. And so it's not like a, why don't you just apply for citizenship kind of thing, which I think is a common misconception, because believe me, if that's all it was, we definitely would have done it. And so really the risks here are, there's a few of them. One, obviously, if DACA goes away, then hundreds of thousands of us are going to be immediately subject to a deportation process. And so we will be placed in removal proceedings or deportation proceedings, and ultimately see whether we get deported. And these type of immigration proceedings, I see them all the time. I represent clients in immigration court all the time. They're very difficult to prevail on. The majority of the time, they lead into a deportation order, and so a lot of it will be subject to that. But the widespread impact is going to be tremendous, because it's not just the DACA recipients who are going to be impacted. It's going to be the people that we serve as well. We're talking about teachers and their students, doctors and their patients, right? Lawyers and their clients. And so it's going to impact millions of people and then billions into the economy well into the future. And so it's going to have a tremendous impact if DACA actually does end, especially with how much our fabric of society has depended on DACA recipients to contribute to it. And so, you know, one of the things, just as a quick aside, one of the things that I found very interesting was when the case was at the Supreme Court in 2019, the American Medical Association wrote an amicus brief to the Supreme Court. And they said, we have all these medical professionals that are DACA recipients that are like so important to the medical field that if for some whatever reason a pandemic were to hit, like we really need them to be here. And this is in November of 2019. And then, you know, we know what happened in 2020. And so the impact of having the DACA program end is going to be tremendously felt.
Wow. Well, I'm so sorry we're out of time. But can you please tell people how to watch your film From Here, From There, and also just a word of advice on how you stay courageous?
You know, you can watch the film From Here, From There on PBS. It's streaming now on PBS, and so you can find it online and on their apps. And you know, one of the things that keeps me motivated and keeps me optimistic, because I am a hopeless optimist, I will say that, but I look at the history of the United States, and I see that the institution that really has moved our society forward has been the institution of people. It hasn't been Congress. It hasn't been some sort of government institution that just did it. It always has been people who have shown up when it really mattered. And when we talk about the civil rights movement or the women's rights movement, it's always been people who showed up. And the U.S. has a long history of having people show up when it matters and forcing the right things to happen. And I have a profound faith on the American people, And that's what the history has shown us. So I know that they're going to show up for us the way that we have shown up for them.
Oh, thank you so much. What a perfect way to end the show. KPFK 90.7 FM Lawyers Guild Show. I'm Maria Hall. Thank you so much to our guests, Luis Cortez Romero and Stephen Rohde, and everyone else, D'Angelo Jones in the and Michael Novak and Jim Lafferty. Okay, bye everyone. We'll see you later.
What life is worth, you would look for yours unhurt, and now will you see the light?